They gave me the thumbs up. Am I on, guys? Am I on? Okay, thanks. Are there two people who would like to hand out some the handouts for me? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We'll get started here shortly. All right, we have a lot of ground to cover, so I'll go ahead and get started. I wish we had one more week, because we could finish out the chapter and then land the plane next week. I'll try to land the plane in bits and pieces, which obviously nobody wants to do. That sounds like a crash. We'll try to land the plane here a little bit as we move on this week to the third chapter of Abolition of Man. And I wanted to do just one more plug, obviously, for the book itself. And then for Michael Ward, probably arguably the greatest living C.S. Lewis scholar right now. He serves at Oxford, but he comes over to the United States quite a bit. But his book, After Humanity, it's like a commentary. I have a bunch of books on my shelf about Abolition of Man, but this is a more recent one. Very good. So After Humanity by Michael Ward, if you want to learn more. I highly recommend that. All right, so let's just do a quick recap. So we have the first chapter, Abolition of Man. Remember, it's three lectures. And one thing about C.S. Lewis, right, is he's a lyrical author. And what he argued about language, and we'll see it a little later, language was his world, how languages were created, how language is used. Remember, that's where he focuses the first chapter. He is so incensed by the way language was being reformed, and he used the waterfall example, right? But language to Lewis was meant, all of his writings were meant to be spoken. And Lewis had a deformity in his thumbs. Lewis never used a typewriter. He wrote every single one of his works. Everything he ever did in his life, he hand wrote for the early part of his life with a fountain pen, no less. So he wrote everything with a fountain pen and then had his brother Warney type it out. But largely it wasn't because, I mean, the deformity in his thumbs, it was hard for him. He would have to like hunt and peck like some of us still do, right? He could have accomplished that, but he said the mind needs to hear the words of truth, and he couldn't do that with the sound of the clacking, because it interrupted the rhythm, the lyrical rhythm of his words. He said it's how you hear the word, spoken word. So he was always thinking about the hearer. How is this going to come across? And so every single thing he ever wrote was written with a fountain pen, because his mind, he's almost like singing it. And if you know him and Lewis and music, singing creation, it's in all throughout The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Last Battle, and in other places. It's in Tolkien. But these guys, these thinkers, were thinking about singing creation into being. And so the word meant a lot to Lewis. and how he described things was very important to him. And so that's why we start with that very first chapter. And he talks about what man is. And so I recommend, if you haven't, how many of you have Audible or something like that where you can listen? His stepson, Douglas Gresham, reads The Abolition of Man on Audible. And so if you want to just listen to it, you get, it's a different, that's why I've tried to read extended passages of it, because it's meant to be heard. You can read it, that's good too, right? But it's meant to be listened to. And so on Audible, Douglas Gresham does a phenomenal job reading The Abolition of Man. So you have this first chapter, you have the idea that he's like, we are men without chests. Remember, mere beast of belly, mere intellect of angel. There's this liaison officer. The chest is the liaison officer between intellect and just mere appetite. And he builds off this frustration of a junior high textbook supposedly teaching the English language to young boys at prep school. And he says it does all but that. It teaches philosophy. It smuggles in a philosophy of what? Remember? Who, say it? Good, thank you. Okay, as a teacher, you like to hear just a little bit. Okay, what are they getting? Subjectivism or emotivism. A couple ways to look at it, but ethical subjectivism, he said, this is what they are getting. They're not getting English language. They're getting philosophy. And remember, he was a moral philosopher. He wanted to be seen as a philosopher, even though all of his degrees were largely in English, classics, and he did take a first in what would be we would consider philosophy now. And almost over half of his students for his entire tutoring career, every period, were philosophers. And so philosophy was very deep in what he was thinking about. And he argues again, remember, that Abolition of Man was his defining work. He was most proud of this work. At the end of his life, this was in a letter at the near the end of his life. So this book, he's like, this is defining. And Michael Ward does a good job in a commentary kind of tracing out in a lot of his essays, in a lot of his fiction, where this then worked. Because this is early in his career, early in his Christian faith. He's using this as a springboard into all of his other work. So we have this first chapter. He argues words mean things. Ethical subjectivism is, in his mind, anathema, heresy, evil. I mean, he's pretty strong in his language. And then he moves into it. He said, well, okay, what else is there then if there's not ethical subjectivism? And he introduces a topic or a concept called the Tao, right? And it takes this Confucian idea. And what he lumps under that, what we in the West call natural law, or the law that just is, metaphysics. Why is there something rather, you know, a lot of people think metaphysics, you know, you're in Barnes & Noble. I don't even think Barnes & Noble has a philosophy section anymore, do they? But if you hear metaphysics in the modern world, usually it's like crystals and like hippies and patchouli oil, you know, metaphysics. And that's not obviously what it was. Metaphysics comes out of Aristotle and his great works, and metaphysics sounds like a heavy topic. All it means is after the physics. The editor that was putting Aristotle's works together, simply he's like, this wasn't titled, and he put it literally after the physics. So metaphysics, it sounds like this real deep idea, but he literally, it was just the book, the chapter that came after Aristotle's physics. So it's kind of fun. Little story, that was for free. But metaphysics is like the idea of what is really real. How do I know what reality is? And for Lewis, classical, traditional, Western mindset, he was thinking, the truth is out there. And this is what this natural law, or this Tao, and he showed through the Stoics, through Eastern religions, through Hinduism, right? He's quoting along with the philosophers of the classic age, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, and then even he smuggles in a few Bible verses to try to line that up, even though, again, remember, this isn't, and some of you are like, Dan, probably, Maybe you've had a thought, like, why are we even talking about this if this isn't like a Sunday school book? He doesn't say Jesus in it, you know. Should we be even studying this at church? But I think what he's getting after is like ultimate reality. How do we know what's real? And it's almost like a pre-evangelism, trying to engage with people. Because he's worried about subjectivism. If truth is out there, but the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, was teaching people that the truth is in here, and as I emote, it's about my feelings, my sentiment, what I believe about a thing is what makes it true, then that is taking people off of the way. Remember, the Tao means the way. Interestingly, that's what Christians, you know, early Christians, the way. And so, the second chapter, he maps through this idea of what he means by the Tao. And if you remember, he ends the chapter, he's engaging, he's like, look, this isn't a Christian book, I want to introduce these ideas. And he's like, there's a very other possibility. He's arguing there's a lot of disagreement among Hinduism, Confucianism, etc., right? He goes, of course there's disagreement, but all of those disagreements in these religions, philosophies, ideologies have their origin in the Tao. And he ends the second lecture saying, but there's altogether another possible answer to this conundrum. And people, and he goes, I'll need another essay to engage this. And so his third lecture, people come back the third night. Over 700 people came to the first lecture, blew out the door. I mean, they had never had that many people. And then it drops by like 100 each night. You can go back to the records, you know, people are like, what is going on, you know? But still, even at his lowest number, the third night, it was higher than they had had in decades at the Riddell Memorial Lectureship. And so to about 500, he gives this final lecture on, he goes, okay, and that's where the title of the book, that's the last lecture he gave, is the title, Abolition of Man. And so on your essay, on the handout, if you have it, just again, just basic outline, you can take notes as you will. He starts with this story. This is how he opens. This is the opening sentence. Man's conquest of nature is an expression often used to describe progress of applied science. Man has nature whacked, said a friend of mine. In their context, the words had a certain tragic beauty, for the speaker was dying of tuberculosis. No matter, he said, I know I'm one of the casualties. Of course there are casualties on the winning as well as losing side, but that doesn't alter the fact that it is winning. I have chosen this story as my point of departure in order to make it clear that I do not wish to disparage all that's really beneficial in the process described as man's conquest, much less all the real devotion and self-sacrifice that has gone into making it possible. So this idea of technology, the idea of growth, the idea of human science, what he calls applied science. But having done so, I must proceed to analyze this conception more closely. In what sense is man the possessor of increasing power over nature? Let us consider three typical examples: the airplane, the wireless, and the contraceptive. In a civilized community, in peacetime, remember when he's writing this? 42, delivers it in early 43, kind of big things going on in Britain. In the civilized community, in peacetime, anyone who can pay for them may use these things. But it cannot strictly be said that when he does so, he's exercising his proper or individual power over nature. If I pay you to carry me, I am not myself, therefore, a strong man. Any or all of these three things I have mentioned can be withheld from some men by other men, by those who sell, and those who allow the sale, and those who own the sources of production, and those who make the goods. What we call man's power in reality is a power possessed by some men, which they may or may not allow other men to profit by. Very interesting concepts. There is about 7 or 8 springboards that I could go into a whole separate lecture in this chapter. But he's talking about when we think about applied science, when we think about technique or technology or the opportunity of man's power over nature, he chooses 3 that were very obvious to the hearer. The airplane, the wireless, and the contraception. And this is contraception not in the pill sense, because that didn't come about until the late 50s, early 60s. In fact, it wasn't even legal in Britain until the 61, 62, so at least 2 decades. So what he's referring to is something a little different. And the reason he's using these examples is because the airplane, which he flew here or there like 2 or 3 times in his life, he flew. He used the radio. He was on the radio all the time, right? The BBC, Mere Christianity, etc. Screwtape Letters was in serial formation as well through written form and then performed on BBC. So he was for the radio. I have no idea his opinions on contraception or personal engagement with it. But the reason those 3 things are most important is because the Nazi front was using the airplane to do what? Bomb. They were using the wireless radio, the radio to do what? Propagandize. And they were using, and again, he uses the word contraception, but anybody know the big word? He's actually eugenics. So he's pointing at the concept of shaping humanity. And again, the full nature of the experiments, the final solution, weren't known. There were hintings, there was knowledge of certain things that the Nazis were speaking about in their propaganda, but the full eugenic history hadn't been unveiled yet. And that would take 2, 3, 4 more years. And so he's using those things, saying there's good and bad in applied science. People who build airplanes, you can travel, great, go visit your friends, or you can bomb your neighboring country. The wireless, harmless entertainment, music, news, or full propaganda. This is, of course, what Jacques Ellul, the French thinker, was most engaged. If you want to read one of the finest discussions and engagements, the concept of modern propaganda, it's Jacques Ellul's book, Propaganda. Very, very good. That's a whole nother lecture. And so Lewis has this in the front, right? He's speaking this to an audience who would make some of those connective tissue ideas. And so when we think about, he goes on to say, from this point of view, what we call man's power over nature turns out to be a power exercised by some men over other men with nature as its instrument. It is, of course, commonplace to complain that men have hitherto used badly and against their fellows the powers of science. But that is not necessarily the point I'm trying to make. I'm not speaking about particular corruptions and abuses which an increase in moral virtue might cure. I am considering the thing called man's power over nature and what it must always and essentially be. So what he's saying is, in metaphysics, if you remember back to Philosophy 101, if you had metaphysics, there's a difference between universals and particulars. There are universal concepts and then particular instantiations of those concepts, right? You didn't know you're getting a little Phil 101 today. But so he's like, I'm not talking about the particulars. So he's doing true metaphysics. He's saying, let's talk about I'm talking about the universal principle. What does it mean that man has nature whacked? And just a few sentences down, he argues that let's look forward in 100 centuries that man keeps using power. And he makes this claim. The real picture is that of one dominant age. Let us suppose the 100th century AD, which resists all previous ages most successfully, dominates all subsequent ages irresistibly, and thus is the real master of the human species. But even within this master generation, the power will be exercised by a minority smaller still, Man's conquest of nature, if the dreams of some scientific planners are realized, means the rule of a few hundred of men over billions and billions of men. The more the men get power, people, mankind, you know, the more smart, scientifically conditioned people get power, there's this massive, massive pyramid. And he says that the world will be ruled by a few hundreds of men and rule over the billions. There neither is nor can be a simple increase of power on man's side. Each new power won by man is a power over man as well. Each advance leaves him weaker as well as stronger. In every victory, besides being the general who triumphs, he is also the prisoner who follows in the triumphal car. So he's saying there's positives and negatives. So he's not anti-science. But what he's echoing, or maybe Paul, I can't ascertain this, but the Italian philosopher Paul Virilio has a way of saying it, and he quoted it 10 years after this essay. And so I don't have proof, but Paul Virilio argues it this way. When you invent the ship, you also invent the shipwreck. When you invent the plane, you also invent the plane crash. When you invent electricity, you also invent electrocution. The negativity of any creation is created at the same time therein. See what he's doing there? In any technological advance, he's echoing what Lewis is saying, whether he came to it on his own or not, the influence is there. This concept that every technology has a positive and a negative side. Technology is not neutral. The idea of conversation of technology is just a tool. Well, tools aren't neutral. It drives me nuts, especially in I engage a lot with technology, Industrial Revolution, that's my area of expertise. I lecture on it all over. Particularly, what's the topic on everybody's mind right now? AI, AGI, you know, artificial general intelligence, these concepts. And people are like, oh, you know, artificial intelligence is just a tool. That's like saying the sky's blue. Pretty obvious. Yeah, it's a tool. But they're trying to use it as like, oh, it's just like a hammer. Well, a hammer can be used to hit a nail, or I use baseball bats with my students because most of you have probably seen a gangster movie, right? Baseballs can hit home runs. Baseball bats can hit home runs, or baseball bats can whack somebody and throw them in the trunk and you go bury them out in the woods. A baseball bat can be a murderer, you know, an instrument of murder. Tools aren't neutral. Don't let anybody in this space, when you talk about technology, and they just say, well, it's just a tool. Well, yeah, that's okay. I mean, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with the phrase. I'm disagreeing what they're trying to smuggle in, what they mean by it's just a tool. The tool itself has positive and negative uses. Conversation is pretty hot and heavy over the last 10 or 20 years here in America is guns, right? Guns don't kill people. People kill people. Well, yeah. True, but World War I wouldn't have been what it was without the technological advance in gas, tanks, and the machine gun, the Mark 42. You look, study World War I, remember, Lewis was in a trench in which his supervising officer was vaporized next to him. Unfortunately, by a short shell from his own side. It was a British shell that landed in the trench. His officer, they don't know if he was buried or vaporized. That's how the notes go. He was just gone. Lewis had full shrapnel, and his closest friend was wounded quite badly as well. And so this idea of war, this idea of technology, and what I find interesting is some of you might know Norman Borlaug. Norman Borlaug, arguably the man who saved the most people in the world other than Jesus Christ. Norman Borlaug invented wheat, a type of wheat that allowed the world to not go into famine in the 50s and 60s. Google it. He's the most unknown savior of the world is Norman Borlaug. And when you study his world, there are people who helped him in his work, and two of them are German scientists. So to prove this, technology is good and bad, two German scientists help figure out nitration, fertilizer. In this process, in the story of Norman Borlaug, there's these, and then their names are escaping me. I have them in notes. I didn't bring it up. But these two specific German, they figured out nitration, they figured out fertilizer, but at the very same time, they're figuring out this idea of liquid fertilizer. If you ever go out west, I mean, maybe even here in Michigan, I grew up out west, vast, you know, fields of soybeans and corn and wheat. You smell during certain seasons the liquid fertilizer that go, they have these big tanks, these big booms. I've seen them out here and there. That can be traced back to these very two specific German chemists. What did these also very two specific German chemists develop for the Germans? The nitration, the certain ways of using the nitrations, the gas, and they built explosives and toxic gas at the same time. So on one level, their invention went one way. On another level, their same invention went another. No technology is neutral. And so Lewis, you know, he's arguing by eugenics, and eugenics simply means good birth, right? The study of heredity and of human race by controlled and selective breeding. We you know, the Germans called them useless eaters. So people that were useless eaters, that they didn't have a utilitarian use in society, they ended up doing the final solution, gassing them for religious, ideological, sexual, and just use-based, you know, people that I know that were developmentally challenged and things, they just gassed them. They were unuseful. And they wanted to develop a master race using eugenics. This is as old as Thomas Malthus. This is the Malthusian dilemma, 1766. Charles Darwin flirted in this space. And then, of course, it's Francis Galton in 1888, 1911. So Lewis's very clearly worldview, Francis Galton is developing and coining the term eugenics for the first time in 1883. Good birth or good product is what the word eugenics means. Well, the Germans kind of perfected it, but do you know where it was really the money, the scientific monies behind the study of eugenics? What country mastered it first? United States. The United States exported through the Rockefeller Foundation, in fact, the cornerstone of the main scientific building of which the German final solution ideas were conjured up, the cornerstone of the building was thankful to the, I work in philanthropy, I should figure out this language, thankful to the generous donations of the Rockefeller Foundation, however you say that in German. It's probably this long in German, right? But Yeah, one word that long, right? And so the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and there's one other that just three major foundations figured out the idea of sterilization, and we're playing in the, and it was pushed largely by religious leaders. So many pastors and theologians got behind this in the idea of eugenics. It's quite crazy. Less than a little over 100 years ago, in Indiana, just south of us, in 1907, forced sterilizations were commonplace in prisons and jails. And then less than 100 years ago, 98 years ago, in the famous Supreme Court case in 1927, Buck versus Bell, you have Oliver Wendell Holmes, the Supreme Court Justice of the United States, saying the very famous quote that some of you might know, when he issued and allowed forced sterilizations to happen in the Mrs. Buck case, that three generations of imbeciles are enough. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, Supreme Court Justice of the United States, says forced sterilizations is legal, should be legal. Christine Rosen, who lately has come to faith, which I find as an absolute miracle, followed Christine Rosen almost 25 years. She wrote this book before she was a Christian. The Power of the Gospel, like 2 years ago, I was moved to tears when I heard that she came to become a follower of Christ. But she wrote a book called Preaching Eugenics. Preaching Eugenics. She traces the religious angle of eugenics quite well. So Lewis, he's in the middle of this eugenic experiment in the war, and he's saying, what is this man's power over nature? And he's arguing for every advance, his example is the triumphal car, for every general driving the car down the road, and again, that propaganda would be very obvious with Hitler. You've seen some of those black and white, he kind of perfected that. And you're also the slave following the triumphal car. That nature, when you use these things, every generation that follows the use of a tool or the creation of a tool is the slave to the power of that technology, as well as the beneficiary. Lewis is saying there's both sides to it. We get more efficient, we get better. Norman Borlaug, he helped 1 billion people from dying of starvation with his intensive study of wheat rust. The most boring thing that one could do. It took him 10 years of failures, but he solved this problem for India, for Mexico, for all of these countries that couldn't feed themselves. And now India, thanks to Norman Borlaug, is a net exporter of wheat. Just 2 generations later. And so positives and negatives come with this technology. And so he's playing with this idea of what does it mean to have a power over nature. And he says, the power of man to make himself what he pleases, as we've seen, the power of some men to make other men as they please. In all ages, no doubt, there is nurture and instruction have, in some sense, attempted to exercise this power. I mean, think as parents, we try to mold and shape people. His argument is the situation to which we must look forward to will be novel in 2 respects. So he's saying historically, technology has this effect. But moving forward, remember, this is his most prophetic chapter. Lewis is really not a prophetic writer. This is a pretty strange genre for him. And so he's doing a little prognostication. He's kind of shooting forward. He's saying this coming generation that we look forward to will be novel or new. He said these have happened in the past, these ideas. But there are 2 respects. Number one, power will be enormously increased. Hitherto, the plans of educationalists, I love that word, he's using it very negatively, has achieved very little of what they attempted and indeed what we read them. How Plato argued that every infant should be a bastard nursed in a bureau, or Eliot would have the boy see no men before the age of 7 and after no women. Let that one sink in. That's pretty funny. Terrible, but funny. This is George Eliot. He's quoting. And he said, and John Locke wanted children to have leaky shoes and no turn or interest for poetry. We may well thank the beneficent obstinacy of real mothers, real nurses, and above all, real children for preserving the human race in such the sanity that it possesses. So he's like, look at all the educationalists that want to do this to children. Let children be children, right? And he just quotes 3 historical examples. And then he said, secondly, the difference is even more important in that the older systems... The second difference is even more important. The older systems, both the kind of man that teaches, wished to produce, and their motives for producing him were prescribed in the Tao, so that he wants to be in the Tao. However good or bad, whatever the degree of goodness or badness he's teaching, he still believes in this concept of good or bad. They handed on what they had received. They initiated the young neophyte into the mystery of humanity, which overarched him and them alike. Kind of welcome to the conversation. This is anthropology. This is what humans do. Here we are. And he says, this will be changed. values are now mere natural phenomena. Remember, he's a moral theologian, a moral philosopher. So he's interested in the questions of right and wrong. And that seems so quaint today. We hear about it in church. Man, the Habakkuk chapter, was that heavy or what? Really, just soaking in what Habakkuk is arguing, listening, talking, and engaging from the watchtower? Heavy. Good and bad, righteous, evil. Why is this happening? He's beseeching God on moral grounds. And what Lewis is arguing throughout the entire lecture series is morals is what goes away. It's quaint. Nobody thinks about morals anymore. Science teaches us everything is reducible to matter stuff, electricity and juices flowing through our body. And that only leaves us with the possibility to emote. It's how I feel about a thing that matters. It has nothing externally to do with right and wrong, truth, good, evil. That's Lewis's thesis throughout the entire thing. All feeling is reduced, or all truth, goodness, beauty, as the philosophers say, can be reduced to how I feel about a thing. And see, it's natural phenomena. Values are now mere natural phenomena. Judgments of value are to be produced in the pupil as part of the conditioning. Whatever Tao there is will be the product, not the motive, of education. They know how to produce conscience and decide what kind of conscience they will produce. And so now the term is largely transhumanism that's at play here. And this is from another lecture I gave on a related topic, but I'm just going to quote. How many of you have heard the term transhumanism? Post-humanity? So Lewis is arguing for this concept in 1943. He's projected 80 years, roughly 80 years ago. And Aldous Huxley, right? Some people argue this is somewhat dystopian. His science fiction trilogy, which he's writing at the same time, is a fictionalized account of abolition of man, is dystopian. So you got Huxley writing, you got, who's the other big one? Huxley, Lewis, and who's the other one? Orwell, thank you, 1984. You have this dystopian way of thinking, a lot of people writing in this space in the early 40s. Julian Huxley, Aldous Huxley's his brother, argues this concept in a 1957 essay. That's where we get the word transhumanism. Aldous Huxley's brother coined the term in 1957. And this is directly from his essay. And think, if you're reading along with me, hopefully, I know some of you got great emails this week. Thank you, guys. I didn't respond to some of you. Sorry. Busy week. But I'm getting, some of you are firing me videos. Hey, I saw this on TED Talk. This sounded familiar. Love it. I love the interaction from you guys. But this is exactly, think about the echoes if you're reading along with me. This third chapter, and really the whole book. This is Sir Julian Huxley, 1957. We have pretty much well finished the geographical exploration of the earth. We've pushed the scientific exploration of nature, both lifeless and living, to a point at which its main outlines have become clear. But the exploration of human nature and its possibilities has scarcely begun. A vast new world of uncharted possibilities awaits its Columbus. We are already justified in the conviction that human life as we know it in history is a wretched makeshift, rooted in ignorance, and that it could be transcended by a state of existence based on the illumination of knowledge and comprehension, just as our modern control of physical nature based on science transcends the tentative fumblings of our ancestors. Our ancestors that were rooted in superstition and professional secrecy. I like that, professional secrecy. The human species can, if it wishes, transcend itself, not just sporadically, an individual here in one way, individual there in another, but in its entirety, as humanity, See, he's making the same metaphysical argument. You see that? Instantiation of particulars. He's like, no. Not just a few people doing it, all humanity. He says, perhaps transhuman, or we need a name for this new belief. Perhaps transhumanism will serve. Man remaining man, but transcending himself by realizing new possibilities of and for his human nature. I believe in transhumanism. Once there are enough people who can truly say that, the human species will be on the threshold of a new kind of existence, as different from ours as ours is from the Peking man. It will at last be consciously fulfilling its real destiny. Lewis wrote 15 years in Lewis's lifetime. So you can see Lewis wasn't crazy. He was in the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age. He could foresee things coming down the road. And now we talk about transhumanism all the time. Artificial general intelligence, when will it come alive? Some of us fear, some of us don't. Some of you, I'm not going to raise a hand if you use AI. Pros and cons, yes, it's just a tool. Tools aren't neutral. Whole nother lecture. But he's playing in the ecosystem that was going on intellectually. One of my professors, intellectual historian, he said that usually it takes about 3 generations for an idea to trickle down into popular culture. That was his argument for, and he had a whole reason why, but 3 generations to go from academic ivory tower-ish thought leaders down to popular culture. And we're flirting with that right now. Yes. Julian. You mean what I just read? Yeah, Aldous Huxley's brother. Yep, Julian. He was saying this is his, he coined the term transhumanism as a positive normative step. He wanted that to happen. That quote I read was a direct quote from the essay. I'm not arguing it is a good thing. And that's Lewis is arguing it's not a good. Yeah, fair enough. I'm using that as a foil. I'm showing that Lewis is arguing for this kind of prophetic vision. And here, right within his lifetime, we have other people saying, nah, here's the other side. And we want that. So Julian Huxley would be contra or opposite of what Lewis is trying to argue. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so here, when we're trying to redefine in my notes, I have redefining anthropology, right? That's what's going on here. He spends 10 to 12 pages trying to say, what does this redefinition of man, what is man qua man, man as man look? How does it look? And he said, it's a wholesale redefinition of what mankind is. In 2016, the World Economic Forum argued that we are in the 4th Industrial Revolution. And I'm intrigued by this topic. The World Economic Forum can be kind of weird on a lot of things, but I think this concept, I've got a lot of traction out of this in the last few years. They're arguing that we're entering a 4th Industrial Revolution, not a distinct addition to the 3rd, not an evolution of the 3rd Industrial Revolution, but a distinct 4th Industrial Revolution, largely because of these 3 things. The velocity, scope, and systems impact of the technologies. Breadth and depth of these changes herald the transformation of new systems of production, management, and governance worldwide. If you're a student of intellectual history or remember your industrial revolutions, the industrial revolutions weren't worldwide. They ended up affecting the world, but the first industrial revolution really only happened in 7 countries. 7. Out of the give or take 218, 225, depending on who's counting and which borders shift. The 200-ish countries in the world. And then it grew a little bit more in the second industrial revolution, and then it grew a little bit more in the third industrial revolution, and it didn't, all the impacts weren't felt evenly, as economists say. So we're entering into this where technologically the science fiction, some of the things that was only that were only science fiction can now be you can kind of point to and say, okay, somebody who actually read that believed that. Like Philip K. Dick. Philip K. Dick wrote some of the most inspiring or transformative, you know, for the moral imagination of the science fiction, like Minority Report. You've probably seen some of his movies. Tom Cruise in Minority Report, The Precogs, right? If you could foresee crime happening, the pre-crime division. That's a Philip K. Dick story. Blade Runner. There's tens of the major stories came out of Philip K. Dick. Kind of he died in obscurity and not wealthy, and now his estate didn't reap any of the benefits, but all 12 of his books or short stories have been made into movies. And there are possibilities. Just last week, 2 weeks ago, you have OpenAI Sam Altman trying to think through the eyeball. You follow this? The idea of ultimately finding the only way to not... it's a scanner that he's spent billions of dollars on now that takes a map of the human eyeball. And so it could never be replicated unless you had the eyeball. Well, that's, you know, you've seen that in science fiction movies for 40 years. What do? You just pop out the eyeball, you know, and throw it in the scanner, you know. Sorry. But that you know, and Sam Altman is in this science fiction stuff. He has literally, they call it the trillion-dollar industry of artificial intelligence, this tech space. And so Lewis was worried about this 80 years ago. So finally, he says, we've entered a magician's bargain near the end of the chapter. And it's on page 82 in this copy, but man. Okay, I'm gonna have to land it this way. He says, so this is what he says. He, after he goes through all of this, nothing I can say will prevent some people from describing this lecture as an attack on science. I deny the charge. Real natural philosophers, and there are some alive now, will perceive that in defending value, morality, I defend, among other things, the value of knowledge, truth. So he's linking the idea of right and wrong and morality to the idea of truth, beauty, goodness. Remember, he's Aristotelian. He's ruminating in Aristotelianism. And he says, I defend the value of knowledge that must die like every other when its roots in the Tao are cut. But I can go no further than that. I even suggest that from science herself, the cure might come. I have described as a magician's bargain that process whereby man surrenders object after object, finally himself, to nature in return for power. And I meant what I said. The fact that the scientist has succeeded where the magician failed has put such a wide contrast between them in popular thought that the real story of the birth of science is misunderstood. And remember, he's an expert in the 16th century. One of his formal textbooks, academic books he wrote, was The History of the 16th Century. And he goes on to describe, and he says, the magician's bargain and the scientist's bargain, they're two sides of the same coin. And he goes on, I don't have time to read the whole thing, it's fascinating. He says, for the wise man of old, though, he's contrasting new man, old man, kind of some Adam stuff going on, old man, new, put off, put on. One comment, Michael Ward argues that he's smuggling that in here. I'm not convinced necessarily, maybe not. He would have, of course, been aware of that, put on the new man, put off the old. He says, for the wise man of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality. And the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. See the interplay there? The solution is a technique, and both in the practice of this technique are ready to do things hitherto regarded as disgusting and impious. And then he gives an example of vivisection at this moment of digging up old bodies. They didn't the scientific revolution in England specifically, there were people who would go, they would follow the obituaries, find the person who recently died, and then after they were, I mean, just think about your own loved ones, right? This was common all over. They're not like once or twice and like, ooh, this happened. Not anecdotally, it happened all the time. And there were people who would go follow that procession, get the person in the ground or in the crypt. What would they do that night? Dig them up, pull them out, take them to a lab, and a medical lab would purchase that dead body, but it was fresh meat, and they would do all their vivisections on them. Good and evil, but he was saying, you know, much good came from that, the understanding of the human body, right? But he was saying, yeah, that's not good as a concept. So he goes on to describe some of these things that were happening in the 16th and 17th century. But then finally, to land this thing, I'm just going to do it this way. So these are the last two paragraphs of the lecture. This is how he literally lands this lecture series, these three sets of lectures, this way. To reduce the Tao to a mere natural product is a step of that kind, he refers to earlier. Up to that point, the kind of explanation which explains things away, he's arguing modern science simply debunks. Remember, he uses that term, conditions us to debunk. Debunk truth, debunked value, debunk it. Up to that point, the kind of explanation which explains things away may give us something, but at a heavy cost. You cannot go on explaining away forever. You will find that you have explained explanation itself away. You cannot go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. It is good that the window should be transparent because the street or garden beyond is opaque. You want to see something through the window. How if you saw through the garden too? It is no use trying to see through first principles. If you see through everything, then everything is transparent. But a wholly transparent world is an invisible world. To see through all things is the same as not to see. Done. He's arguing through these three series of lectures that our culture, his culture in the 1940s, is blind to reality because of the case that he built over those lectures. And that if we don't seek to recover somehow, and we all do it to certain degrees, positively or negatively, to live in the Tao, reality, natural law, first principles, how he says at the end, very philosophical term, we will be blind to goodness, truth, and beauty, which again is why I argue about pre-evangelism. He's saying if you can't understand the concept of good, if you think God is in me, if you think God, I am God, I am the master of my own nature, you are blind. And not just a deformed man, you are something wholly other than man. Pretty prophetic, pretty heavy, lot to think about and talk about. Love you guys. Thanks for sticking with me over a very short time in this context. Let me pray at least over us. Lord God, these are intense topics. I believe in you, the maker of truth, the maker of creation, the maker of our brains, our minds, and our souls. God, help people to sift through this, to fight with this, to wrestle with these ideas, but ultimately rest in you, external to us. Thank you for sending Jesus as a man in the flesh, as we read through the Nicene Creed this morning, so that we may know you who are seated at the right hand of God, intercessing for us in the spiritual realm, but loving us in the physical realm no less as your creation. In your name we pray. Amen.